Today, why is the Home Office keeping asylum seekers in former army barracks?
I was staying at a hotel in London for 3 weeks, and then one day in the morning after 3 weeks, the reception called me and said, pack your stuff, you're going to be transferred. And I was really confused and anxious because when you're in that position, you can't predict what's going to happen next, where you're going to go. Maybe it's going to be a dispersed accommodation or maybe it's going to be a deport center. You cannot predict.
This man, whom we are calling Matan, has come to the UK from Iran and is seeking asylum.
When I packed my stuff and went out, I asked the taxi driver where we are going to, and he didn't respond because maybe I think they had the fear that if they inform the people, they're going to escape. So I just found out when I saw the Folkestone sign on the road when we were heading to Napier Barracks.
Napier is a former army barracks in Kent, but it hasn't been used to house the military for 15 years. Now the Home Office has repurposed it as accommodation for up to 400 vulnerable asylum seekers. It's one of two sites they're using. The other is Pennelly in Wales. Ministers say it's temporary accommodation because of the pressures of COVID-19. But to men like Matan, who are not supposed to be detained, it feels like being sent to jail.
When I got there, it totally felt like a prison. The fences, the security guards are all around you, and you're really under control. Your movement hours are limited to times that they giving you. Everyone is observing you. And I mean, if you ask me personally, it was worse than prison. When you're in a prison, you know why you are being detained and you know how long you're going to be there. But these are not the cases when you're in Napier Barracks as an asylum seeker.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, inside Napier, the former army barracks being used to house asylum seekers. I want to warn you before we start that we mention self-harm and suicide in this episode. Jamie Grierson, as Home Affairs correspondent for The Guardian, can you take us to the basics of this story? What are Napier and Pennelly, and when did they start being used to house people who were seeking asylum?
In September 2020, it emerged that the Home Office had set up a deal with the Ministry of Defence to use two former military sites, one called Napier Barracks, just outside of Folkestone in Kent, and the other called Pennelly Barracks in Pembrokeshire in South Wales, to temporarily house asylum seekers. There was very little consultation. The news of the sites being used emerged through local authorities and local MPs who objected from the outset, and that's how it was brought to the attention of the public and the press.
For the majority of this episode, we're going to be focusing on Napier Barracks because what's been happening there has been dramatic, to say the least.
You could get arrested. If you get arrested, then you might have your asylum taken away. So
the men inside have taken to the streets surrounding the barracks in protest over grim conditions they are living in.
Gentlemen, under the Human Rights Act, you have a right to protest.
OK, are they out for exercise or are they protesting? Because they told me exercise.
No, we need to run.
Right. You are out protesting. That's not what you're here for.
But the Home Office tell us that they're doing this because they want to offer value for money for the taxpayer, because currently migrants are housed in hotels while they're asylum.
How did you first get alerted to it?
I started getting calls from volunteers working with charities in the local area to provide donations to the site. And they were raising concerns about the conditions at Napier Barracks. And what they were telling me really did shock me, particularly the overcrowding on the site.
There are 14 blocks that house the residents, the asylum seekers. They can house 28 people each, and the people who are inside are sharing two toilets and two showers in total. So even when it's not during a pandemic, this place was not suitable and not hygienic to keep 400 people in one place. For example, when I got there, I got scabies.
Scabies?
Yeah, in first 2 or 3 weeks that I was staying there.
What does scabies do to you? How does it make you feel?
Well, I had to scratch all my body, all parts of my body, and it became really red and rash. I couldn't sleep at night because I couldn't resist scratching my body. And two other of my friends in my block had the same problem. So it was like contagious. When you put 400 people from different backgrounds, different cultures, and the hygiene is really poor, the chance of getting any kind of disease is really high.
It struck me that this was not at all COVID secure or appropriate for the time. But on top of this, you know, being flung into a military environment, barbed wire around the perimeter that many have described as looking and feeling like a prison, was very alarming for a significant number of the men held inside.
Matam, what sort of things had the people you stayed with in Napier experienced before they got there?
Well, the majority of the asylum seekers there are from Syria, Iran, Iraq. I had one friend, for example, that when he was a child, they used to stay in shelters at night because of the fear they had of the bombing and shootings during Iran and Iraq war. And being in Napier barracks reminded him the situation that he experienced. He couldn't sleep at nights. He was dealing with insomnia. He was taking pills. I mean, I have so many stories about that. I don't know where to begin. They all came across the countries in Europe. They experienced so many things. Smugglers, people who tried to steal their money or take advantage of them. There were people in the camps who are married and have children in their home countries. And being in a situation in camps really worsened their mental health.
How were you spending your days?
In the first days, I was keeping my mind busy by learning French and reading books and helping people when they wanted an interpreter or something. They had problems because not all the people there can speak English. So I had to translate for them. But after some time, like after 2 or 3 months, all of the people there become really hopeless and not okay to socialize with others.
I've been inundated since September with messages from asylum seekers, volunteers, lawyers, doctors, raising different concerns about Napier barracks and also Penally barracks. And this has ranged from allegations of Home Office cover-ups when volunteers were presented with non-disclosure agreements, asking them not to talk to anyone, including the press, about what they had seen within the site. Lawyers getting in touch saying that they've been refused access to the site to speak to people they are actually representing. Doctors raising concerns about the poor access to healthcare. These are all fundamental human rights.
With only one nurse on site at Napier to care for up to 400 men, it's difficult to see how the men's human right to medical access could be fully met. One medic who has been raising concerns about the use of the barracks for months now is Dr. Jill O'Leary. She's the lead GP at the Helen Bamber Foundation, a charity working with refugees and asylum seekers. And she's been trying to help men inside Napier and Penally.
Well, many of the residents that we have assessed are displaying symptoms consistent with post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety and depression. So specifically those symptoms would be flashbacks, nightmares, irritability, anxiety, poor sleep. There's quite a high prevalence of those symptoms among the residents that we've assessed. Both of the sites have shooting ranges nearby, and so it's not uncommon to hear gunfire and sort of heavy artillery from both of those sites where people are staying. You can understand just how triggering and re-traumatizing those noises might be to a large group of traumatized men who are all being housed in these dorms. The first resident I ever assessed was a young man from the Yemen who had made possibly some negative comments about the Yemeni government. He was subsequently imprisoned for 10 to 14 days. He was beaten, starved, tortured before he managed to escape. He then immediately left Yemen, had a very, very difficult journey, largely on foot across Europe to try and get to the UK. Once he arrived in the UK, he was in initial accommodation in London and starting the asylum application process when he was very suddenly moved to Penali Barracks. Being in this military site where there's high barbed wire and mesh and dormitories and shared facilities put him right back to his time in prison in the Yemen. He started getting intense flashbacks, nightmares. He couldn't sleep. He was avoiding being around the other residents wherever possible. And for the first time in his life, he started to have suicidal thoughts. So it was a highly inappropriate environment for him to have been placed in. And it clearly had a very, very detrimental effect on his mental health.
What medical access are the men getting?
I think, first of all, it's really important to say that both of the NHS trusts that were expected to take clinical responsibility for these residents were given approximately 2 days' notice before the residents were moved in. So no healthcare pathways were put in place prior to moving residents into the barracks. I think that's a really important thing to bear in mind. Now, both the CCGs for Napier and Penali have put in really, really hard work in very, very difficult circumstances trying to create healthcare pathways. However, access to healthcare remains really inadequate and there's lots of barriers.
Jill says that if the men want to go off-site to see a doctor, they have to ask permission from the staff at Penali. That means they're forced to divulge their medical conditions, which may be embarrassing or distressing to talk about, to staff who aren't themselves medically trained. It's then up to those members of staff to decide whether or not these people will be able to access medical help.
An example of that would be one resident that we assessed who had symptoms related to previous torture and that involved him having urinary incontinence. He then had to speak to a Clear Springs manager, explain about these symptoms of incontinence that were related to his previous trauma in order to request a visit to see a GP. You wouldn't be surprised to know that he found that completely humiliating and objectively his mental health deteriorated significantly as a result.
I mean, what you're describing also sounds to me like it needs specialist help. I imagine your average GP doesn't often come across people who have suffered such traumatic events and have PTSD in response to that. What are the kind of things that you need to watch out for with PTSD, and how important is it that these men get specialist help?
People who have PTSD, they're likely to behave in ways that can be destructive, impulsive, destructive to themselves and to their environment. They're at much higher risk of mortality and morbidity, and we need to be really conscious of that. One, I think, really upsetting feature of the barracks also is that both sites have become hotbeds for far-right activity. So there's lots of social media groups that are dedicated to monitoring the comings and goings of people from both sites. That involves filming people against their will, taking pictures of them, harassing them, asking them where they came from, when they're leaving. One resident that I spoke to who was experiencing quite severe symptoms of anxiety and depression, and I asked him if there was anything at all in the barracks that gave him some pleasure or some joy. And he told me that he liked going for walks down to the beach. He'd sit by the sea and it would soothe him. But recently, he hasn't been able to do that because every time he leaves the barracks, he gets followed and harassed and shouted at and insulted and filmed by these far-right protesters. So the one thing that gave him some comfort has now been taken away from him.
The other big concern for doctors like Jill is about the risk of COVID-19. Back in November, she and others wrote to the Home Office to voice their concern that there could be outbreaks at these sites. But she says she never got a response. When it came true, Matan was there at Napier.
I can remember that in the first days of January, one block, there were around 5 to 6 infected people in one block, and they isolated the whole block for 2 days. And after 2 days, they opened the fences and let the infected ones mixed with other people's. And when we asked why you did such a thing, they say because the camp is representing a big house and they are allowed to be free in their own house. 1 week after, 120 positive cases were confirmed. I was really frustrated because it wasn't possible to practice social distancing. It wasn't possible to keep yourself safe from the disease. And after I tested positive, I had pain all over my body, shivering at nights, fever, really fatigued. I was still staying in my own room, which wasn't a room, really. It was just, I'm with 13 other people. We were actually 4 positive cases with 10 negative cases sleeping in the same area.
And then things got worse at Napier. In late January, a fire broke out.
The Kent Fire and Rescue Service has said that they have been called to assist Kent Police at the Napier Barracks in Folkestone. 8 fire engines have been sent to the scene, people living and working.
When the fire happened, when I came out of my block, I couldn't see the staff, the people who are in charge, the security guards. The smoke was all over the camp and the flames of the fire was really huge. The firefighters and police were trying hard to make everything calm. But it was the same day that I felt I'm really in a bad situation. I'm really unsafe and I've never experienced this. That was one of the worst memories I've had in my life.
What happened at Napier after the fire? How did life change?
We had no electricity for 2 days, and no hot water, no heaters. I can remember that I was sleeping in cold, dark place for 2 nights.
The fire was horrible for everybody involved. If you couple that with the fact that people are so frightened of contracting COVID since the outbreak has happened in Napier, lots of the dormitories, the residents are opting to sleep with the doors open to allow for ventilation, which I can't imagine how cold that must be at the moment for them.
Jill, when the fire crews went in, they discovered asbestos. How worrying is that for people's health?
The discovery of asbestos just proves the point that these sites are not fit for purpose. They're not fit for anybody to be living in. And so people need to be evacuated as soon as possible.
Jamie, the descriptions we've heard of Napier are terrible. I'm struggling to understand why the government would hold people who are seeking asylum in those conditions. Have there been any inspections?
It's an important point you raise. And no, so far there haven't been any inspections by any independent bodies. And I think that really sets these facilities apart from the established framework that we have to deal with either asylum seekers arriving in the UK or those that the country wishes to deport. In the last few days, we've had confirmation that the Borders and Immigration Inspectorate, along with the Prisons Inspectorate, have been granted access to both Napier Barracks and Penally Camp. And we understand that in the last few days since the inspection was announced, the Home Office has significantly reduced the number of men being held at Napier Barracks to around 50 to 100. Just a few weeks ago, there were, of course, 400 men at Napier Barracks.
I mean, obviously, you can't get in there to have a proper look at what these sites look like. But one message that you get from ministers is, well, these were good enough for our soldiers. Why aren't they good enough for asylum seekers? What is the response from charities and volunteers to that argument?
Well, first of all, they haven't housed military personnel for years. I've seen photos and videos of the buildings inside. The urinals are often taped up, bagged up because they're out of order. There's often water across the floor of the bathrooms. The sleeping areas have no privacy to the point where the men have had to pin sheets up themselves to create, you know, a curtain to give themselves some, you know, sense of dignity if they want to undress. I would be surprised if they would allow military personnel to stay in them as they are now without some significant renovation.
So they've now taken a significant number of people off the site. They're recognising at least that it's been overcrowded. Why is the Home Office using Napier and Penally at all?
The Home Office and the ministers are saying that at the time they started to use the barracks last September, we were dealing with an influx of asylum seekers arriving over the channel. You might recall the reporting at the time of significant numbers of asylum seekers arriving over the channel in small boats. And it is correct that on individual days, there were significant numbers record-breaking numbers arriving on individual days. And so the Home Office said they needed additional contingency accommodation to house this surge in arrivals. It's also the case that because of the pandemic and its impact on migration flows, that actually during that period, the number of asylum applications in total in the UK had fallen because obviously other routes into the country arriving in a lorry or even on a plane were severely limited. So the number of asylum applications actually fell at the time. You have to also set it in the context of a lot of rhetoric and messaging that was coming from the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, and her junior immigration minister, Chris Philp, about how to deal with asylum seekers in the country, which is much harder than we've seen in recent years. There were reports, some of which revealed in The Guardian, about proposals to send asylum seekers to offshore facilities in the South Atlantic. There were proposals to put asylum seekers on retired ferries or oil rigs. Now, none of these things have actually happened, but it's certainly part of a broadening rhetoric that the Home Secretary and her junior ministers have been using. They keep repeating that they believe that the asylum system in the UK is broken. And I think that's one thing that they actually have some agreement with when it comes to the charities, lawyers and the healthcare professionals that I speak to. They think it's broken too, just for different reasons.
Coming up, Matan makes it out of Napier. Will others get the same chance? Matan, last week you were taken out of Napier. What finally happened that meant you could leave?
I was told in the morning, like 9 or 10 a.m., I think, by the staff that I had to pack my stuff. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, when you are told that you're getting out of the prison, you are feeling so much relief. And it was the same feeling for me. When I was in the car on my way to my next accommodation, when I was seeing the buildings, the people, the cars, and the normal life, it's really affected me because I totally forgot how the life is outside of the barracks.
Jamie, Matan, who we've been speaking to, is out of Napier now, and the Home Office has given him a space in a hotel. Can you explain the legal process that's enabled him to get out?
A number of law firms specialising in human rights issues have taken on a number of asylum seekers within Napier as clients and are lodging individual legal claims with the High Court. They claim that the stay of asylum seekers in Napier amounts to degrading or inhuman treatment. And other claims have been based around Article 3, which is unfair imprisonment. In the interim, before the substantial hearings are held at the High Court, in the interim, a couple of judges have already ordered the temporary removal of a number of men from the site, based purely on written submissions, and the judges were convinced enough by those written submissions that the men shouldn't remain on the site, and ultimately there could be a substantial judicial review hearing which will look at the broader issues of the suitability and appropriateness of using these military sites to house asylum seekers.
We've heard from Jill about what she's trying to do to improve the medical access the men in Napier and Penally can have, and a lot of people, medics, lawyers, volunteers and others, are increasingly trying to highlight what is happening on these two sites. In fact, earlier this month, Jill gave evidence to a government select committee.
And has everybody there been tested? All the residents, all the staff working there, has everybody been tested?
No. So access to testing has also been intermittent.
And some of the MPs she spoke to seemed shocked by what she told them.
So people can't all get their test results. They're still sharing accommodation in which there clearly is not social distancing, and there are COVID cases on the site.
Correct.
This is truly shocking. I mean, it's just very troubling information that you are giving us.
What is the likelihood, do you think, of the government shutting the sites down?
It was originally said it would be used until the end of March. However, there have been reports from unnamed sources within the Home Office that they are considering a public consultation to extend its use beyond March. However, there are now a number of legal actions in process which could ultimately threaten the ongoing use of Napier and Pinelli, which is still open.
In the meantime, what will happen to Matan and the people he stayed with?
All of these men have submitted claims for asylum in the UK. Now, the average waiting times for an asylum claim to be processed goes beyond 6 months. Some asylum seekers that I've spoken to in the last few years have waited years. In the meantime, they're in Napier Barracks and they don't know when that answer's coming.
You know, one thing the government says, and I've certainly heard this from previous governments, certainly since 2010, is that people have travelled through safe countries to get here and that they should have claimed asylum in one of those countries instead of the UK. What do you make of that?
The UK received around about 45,000 applications for asylum in 2019. Now, that was less than a third of the applications received by Germany. It was about a third of the applications received by France, and it was far fewer than the number of applications for asylum received by Spain and Greece. Now, we are one of the countries in Europe which has a high number of asylum applications, but we are by no means the country that receives the most. And there are many who have argued that we should be doing a lot more to help refugees in this country.
Jamie Grierson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My thanks to Matan, Dr. Jill O'Leary and Jamie Grierson, who has written loads about this story. Do look up his brilliant reporting at theguardian.com. In connection with the fire at Napier, one man, Mohammed Ali, who is 31, has appeared in court charged with affray, common assault and criminal damage, all of which he denies. 13 other people were arrested and released on bail. We went to the Home Office for a comment on this episode, and a spokesperson told us that they did not recognise what they called inaccurate claims. They said the government provides safe, warm, secure accommodation with 3 nutritious meals served a day, all paid for by the taxpayer. These sites have previously accommodated army personnel, and it is wrong to say they are not adequate for asylum seekers. They said that the pandemic had put the accommodation system under severe strain because of measures to control and manage the public health risk. They added, the government has been working tirelessly to secure extra accommodation to ease the pressure on the system and to meet our statutory obligations to support asylum seekers who would otherwise be destitute. The Ministry of Defence gave us permission to use these temporary sites for 12 months and it will be discontinued when we are able to do so. The government continues to work closely with accommodation providers, charities, local authorities, police and other partners to ensure that the sites operate safely, securely and in line with public health guidelines. That's it for today. A big thanks for all your reviews and feedback on social media. Do keep them coming. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Nicholas Alexander. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.